This is the Future of HR podcast, episode 109.
So a lot of people, when they think about organizational AI ethical risk management program, they think about, well, we're not designing AI, we're not building AI, but look, everyone and their mother is building AI and trying to sell it to your organization. HR being a prime example of, there's tons of AI HR vendors trying to sell you stuff. What do you do with the vendor? So number one, you've got to have the processes in place such that the people in HR who are being sold to, they've got the right questions to ask those vendors. They have the right ways of identifying that there's ethical smoke here, and they know, the, as it were, the alarm to pull. And then it goes to the appropriate people. There has to be something in the procurement process where things get flagged of needing additional review. When it comes to bias in particular, obviously you're going to have lots of questions for that vendor. Did you check for bias? How did you measure the bias? There's different ways of measuring bias. How did you measure the bias? What metric did you use for measuring the bias? What metric did you choose? Why did you choose that metric? Why didn't you choose these other ones? What bias mitigation strategies did you engage in, or what are the tactics that you engaged in? Are there recommendations that you provide for how to best use this thing so as to minimize bias and how we use it?
What does it mean to have ethical AI? How can you ensure your organization is balancing innovation and risk when using AI? Hi, I'm your host, JP Elliott, and this is the Future of HR podcast, the only podcast whose mission is to inspire the next generation of HR leaders. On each episode, I interview successful HR executives and thought leaders who are reimagining, rethinking, and leading our field into the future. During our candid conversations, you will learn about their career journeys, their lessons learned along the way, and their insights on how to take our field, and most importantly, your career, to the next level. If you're a fan of the Future of HR podcast, then you know that I'm a big fan of Deeper Signals. Deeper Signals is a modern scientific assessments platform that is revolutionizing the way organizations measure, manage, and develop their talent. And in the age of AI, soft skills are becoming more and more crucial. And that's why their latest innovation to the Deeper Signals platform, Skills Selector, is a game changer that we've all been waiting for in soft skills-based hiring. Here's why I'm impressed with Skills Selector. Number one, it's lightning fast. You get to assess a candidate's soft skills in just 10 minutes. It's fully customizable. You can create customized job profiles that perfectly match your company's needs and your competency frameworks. It's visually intuitive. You can compare candidates side by side instantly. And it doesn't just stop at hiring. It seamlessly transitions into personalized onboarding and development plans so your new hires can hit the ground running from day one. And the best part, it's all backed by science and cutting-edge data analytics. But don't take my word for it. Go to deepersignals.com/futurepod. That's deepersignals.com/futurepod. And try their core drivers assessment for free. It'll give you a sneak peek of the insights you'll gain with the Skills Selector. And they're going to give you a 14-day free trial to the entire Deeper Signals platform. Don't miss this chance to transform your hiring process. Go to deepersignals.com/futurepod today and see how Skills Selector can make your hiring smarter, faster, and more effective. Hey everyone, it's been 3 months since I doubled down on my mission to develop the next generation of HR leaders, and I wanted to give you a brief update. First, it is going incredibly well. Thank you so much for your support. And I'm so thankful for the Future of HR podcast community. At the core of my mission is the Next Gen HR Accelerator Program, which is the most comprehensive leadership development program for HR directors and managers. It focuses on business acumen, strategic thinking, influence and executive communication skills, and how to translate business strategy into actionable, value-added HR initiatives. But this isn't just a program where you get tools, methodologies, and frameworks. This is about developing leaders. And the participants get 360 feedback, coaching from me, and a targeted from-to development plan. Our current cohort includes HR leaders from Nike, McDonald's, Kohler, and more. And the next cohort starts January 21st, 2025. I do expect it to sell out as registration will close on December 20th. To learn more, visit nextgenhracelerator.com or reach out to me directly. Second, Elevate by Future of HR is just 1 week away, and I could not be more excited. We have over 100 HR leaders who'll be learning from 21 of the best minds in our field. And while early bird pricing is over, you can still reserve your spot at Elevate by going to elevatebyfutureofhr2024.com. Also, since I announced my mission to go full-time on developing next-generation HR leaders, I've been asked to be a keynote speaker for 7 different internal HR conferences or career weeks of Fortune 500 companies. This has been an honor and a blast. And what am I speaking about? Well, I'm leveraging my 100-plus interviews in the podcast and my 20-plus year career as a talent HR executive to talk about how HR leaders can have more influence and impact and what I call the influence equation. I also speak about how we can future-proof your HR career in the age of AI and the future trends impacting our field. I love speaking to HR teams, and I've been extremely grateful for these opportunities. If you're looking for a speaker in your 2025 HR conferences, career weeks, or meetings, I'd love to talk. Now, last but not least, part of my mission is to help organizations to elevate their talent practices, and I've been doing some consulting in the talent space. In fact, at the moment, I'm helping a $1.2 billion fast-growing tech company to create their first leadership development program to ensure they have the leaders to scale and deliver their ambitious growth goals. If you or your organization is looking to elevate your talent practices or need some assistance or just would like an outside and objective perspective, please reach out as I'd love to help. And what have I been learning the past 3 months? Well, my biggest learning is that if you're willing to put in the work, the long hours, yes, I probably do work 7 days a week, and you focus on creating value for others, and you're willing to bet on yourself, it can pay off. Now look, I've got a long way to go to bring my mission to life, but so far I'm off to a great start, and that is really thanks to you and for your support. And with that, I want to introduce this week's guest, Reid Blackman. Reid is the author of Ethical Machines, Your Concise Guide to Totally Unbiased, Transparent, and Respectful AI. He's also the founder and CEO of Virtue, a digital ethical risk consultancy. Reid is also an advisor to the Canadian government on their federal AI regulations and a founding member of EY's AI Advisory Board and senior advisor to Deloitte's AI Institute. His work, which includes advising and speaking to organizations including Amazon Web Services, U.S. Bank, the FBI, NASA, and the World Economic Forum, have all been profiled by the Wall Street Journal, the BBC, and Forbes. His written work has appeared in the Harvard Business Review and the New York Times. Prior to founding Virtue, Reid was a professor of philosophy at Colgate University and UNC Chapel Hill. This was an insightful conversation with Reid as we talked about why balancing innovation and ethical considerations is crucial for HR functions using AI in talent processes, how HR leaders can mitigate AI risks by properly vetting vendors and asking the right questions about bias detection and mitigation, the role of HR in communicating ethical AI practices and fostering a culture of trust and transparency, the importance of adopting appropriate metrics to measure bias and fairness in AI, and why HR leaders should not be intimidated by AI, but instead should learn AI to ensure it's implemented in an ethically and responsible way, and much, much more. I'd love to hear your thoughts in this episode as you listen, so drop me a line on LinkedIn and say hello. And now let's jump into my conversation with Reid. Reid, welcome to the Future of HR podcast. How are you?
So far, so good, but early in the podcast, things can go downhill.
Yeah. Reid, it's great to have you on the Future of HR podcast. Your book, Ethical Machines, it's just so interesting right now because what's going on in AI. And so it's just great to have an expert on ethical AI and the research you've been doing. But I want to kick it off and talk a little bit about your career. And prior to launching your ethics consultancy, Virtue, you were a professor, yet you had this calling to be an entrepreneur. Tell us more about the story about that and why you started Virtue.
Okay, yeah. So let's see. I mean, there's a lot of different strands here. I mean, I suppose I always had some kind of, I don't love the word entrepreneur. These days, it sounds too self-aggrandizing. Lots of people are entrepreneurs, like just open a pizza shop. Now you're an entrepreneur. You're not scaling. You're not getting VC funding, but you're an entrepreneur. You started a pizza shop. Good for you. And nowadays, it's like, I'm an entrepreneur. You're doing something that you're an astronaut. Anyway, so I don't love the term, but I've always sort of had that idea or attitude of, I wonder if I can make money on this. I wonder if I can sell that thing. When I was a little kid and I learned how to make bracelets with, what do they call it, lanyard or some of that plastic stuff, my mom told me that one of the mothers called her and she was upset because I was charging her son a dime to make him a bracelet or something. I was always doing that kind of thing. Anyway, my dad is a proper, I think, entrepreneur, started a business from scratch and built it and sustained a family. He really came from nothing and built a viable business that sustained our family very well for a long time, still does. So I think I grew up around it. That's one thing to say. So it was familiar to me to work for yourself. And when I was in high school, my dad was an auto parts wholesaler. So he would deliver auto parts to garages and I would deliver auto parts to garages. So I'd go around delivering in high school. And then eventually I started selling stuff to these convenience stores. The business changed. He started selling to convenience stores. All the gas stations that had garages turned into gas stations with convenience stores. Then I found myself each summer selling incense, selling light up pacifiers when that was big in the rave community. I was selling those for a summer. Sunglasses, beef jerky, selling all the stuff. Eventually, fireworks became legal in Connecticut. Low-grade stuff, safe stuff, nothing that's explosive or flies up in the air. But anyway, that's when I started a fireworks business and my dad started a fireworks business and they were running in parallel to each other. And by this time, I was in grad school and it turned out to be way more successful than I anticipated. And to make a long story short, we ultimately combined our two separate businesses and I sort of ran operations for a seasonal fireworks wholesale distribution company for 15 plus years. Then I became, it actually leads into Virtue, why I started Virtue, how I came into start Virtue, because when I was a professor, I was asked to be a mentor to startups at the entrepreneurship organization within the university because of the fireworks stuff. So I said, yes. And then I saw all these kids doing cool, new, interesting stuff. I thought, I want to do something cool and new and interesting. What would that be, though? I love philosophy. I love ethics in particular. I guess it would be an ethics consultancy, but what the hell is that? Is there such a thing? At the time, no, that I could find anyway. And when I Googled it, but then fast forward and eventually I left academia and I started an ethics consultancy.
That's a great story. And yeah, I think, yes, the word entrepreneur can be sort of a little bit self-aggrandizing, but
yeah,
it takes a lot of guts and gravitas to put something out there and push forward and bring something of value to the world, whether it's fireworks or an ethics consultancy, which frankly, I think we need that more than ever. So I love your background. It's just so different from professor to that. And then let's talk about Ethical Machines, which is an amazing book. But what made you decide to write that? And then my second part to that question would be, what's changed since you wrote it in 2022?
Okay, why did I write the book? There's obviously a number of reasons. I was always frustrated by the level of conversation on AI ethics. I thought that, frankly, there were a bunch of people who didn't know much about AI and knew much less about ethics talking about AI ethics. They just made tons of false claims. They were confused about things. They didn't really know how to talk about it. They didn't know how to think about it, but some of them were purporting to know what they were talking about. And so I wanted a book that just said, listen, just take a step back. Here's how you need to think about ethics. Here's how you need to think about what AI is in the context of ethics. Here's how you need to think about AI ethics. Here's what you need to do about it. It was really an extension of me being a professor, right? So as a professor, yes, I did, of course, a bunch of research and I published papers and all that. But part of being a professor is that you teach classes. And the book to me was an extension of my being a professor where I had to tell everyone, anyone who would listen anyway, here's what AI ethics is all about. AI ethics in business, right? Not in government. So the book is a business book, right? It's for people in business, not for policymakers. I think it's useful for them, but it's not officially for them. It was me being a professor to the business audience around AI ethical, reputational, and regulatory risks of AI.
That's helpful. And it's a great distinction that this is really for business leaders, which I think are grappling with generative AI more than ever, right? As it becomes this, generative AI is now taking over and becoming more mainstream. We're seeing it in all aspects of our lives. AI ethics is even more critical. Explain to us a little more about what AI ethics is and why it's important and how you define it.
Yeah, so a couple things. Number one, I realized I didn't answer the second half of your last question, which was what's different? But you did. You said generative AI, and that wasn't a thing. I mean, it was a thing, but it wasn't the thing that it is now. So when I wrote the book, it was pre the release of ChatGPT, whatever it was, 3.5 or whatever it was at the time. That was a big change, especially bursting AI into public consciousness. The fundamentals of what AI really is, though, and the risks that are involved mostly say the same. So to your point, why is it relevant to business or how does it speak to them? What is AI ethics in business? I think it's primarily about risk management, risk mitigation. There's real reputational risk, right? They act unethically. There's reputational risk both among their employees and among their consumers or clients. There's regulatory risk mitigation because there's lots of things that are against regulations or against laws that you can do with AI accidentally. Probably the most well-known example being discrimination. So you can engage in discriminatory behavior against, say, historically marginalized or legally protected subpopulations. You could do it with AI by accident, and that's against the law right now. You don't need a new special law for it. So I think that there's a lot to be said about risk management. And then if I wanted to put a positive spin on it, that I would say that it enables innovation for the non-insane, non-crazy companies. So companies that just want to move fast and break all the things, and they're going to financially outrun their problems, like a Facebook. Okay, that's one model. You could do that. It's unethical, I think, but it can be done. They're doing it. Or at least they've historically done it. But a lot of organizations, especially the organizations that have been around forever, blue chip stocks, the Fortune 500 companies that are not also these giant aggressive tech companies, the ones that are not native tech companies, they have real brands that they've cultivated over the course of decades, and in some cases over a century. They need to protect their reputation. They also need to innovate, because even though they're giants, they don't want to get left behind. They do want to innovate, but they don't want to innovate in a way that's reckless, either with people or society or their brand, the long-term sustainability of their organization. For those kinds of organizations in particular, it becomes very important to start paying attention to this stuff. And not just paying attention, but actually implementing, doing things to make sure that things don't go ethically sideways.
Hey, everyone. After a quick break, we'll be right back to our conversation with Reid Blackman. I'm excited to let you know that I've recently put together a succession planning playbook that you can download for free at futureofhr.com. And whether you want to assess your current approach to succession planning or you're building your leadership development strategy from scratch, this playbook offers an actionable framework designed to help you understand what great succession planning looks like. So go to futureofhr.com and download the succession planning playbook today.
As I was looking through reading the book, you said AI has an amazing ability to discriminate. And I love that quote, but tell us more about what you meant by that and what can we do about that piece?
So I don't remember that exact quote, but that seems true. Sometimes people call it bias in AI. Sometimes they call it discriminatory AI. The main idea is AI can, let's say it's quote unquote reading resumes, looking at job applications, doing credit risk ratings, giving insurance premiums. And it's very easy for it to become discriminatory against, say, Black people, as an example. And when it does these things, it does it at scale. So it's not like there's just one hiring manager who's a racist and that's causing some problems. It's, hey, we're using this AI, we're deploying it and using it across tens of thousands of resumes we receive every day. If it turns out to be discriminatory, it's not analogous to that hiring manager who's no good. It's, oh my God, every single hiring manager, insofar as we replace them with AI, is discriminatory at this point. It does that. The short explanation for how does it get to be that way, the short explanation is that AI is just software that learns by example. I say this all the time. I say it in the book, but I wish I could go back and sort of trumpet this claim in the book. AI is software that learns by example. That's all it is. It's software that learns by example. And I don't care if you're talking about narrow AI or generative AI. It's still software that learns by example. If it learns from the examples, hey, we don't really hire women around here because it looks at the historical hiring data, for instance. There could be a bunch of reasons why we don't hire women around here, but we don't hire women around here. Then it's going to learn from those examples. We don't hire women. And then it starts red lighting all the women's resumes and green lighting the men's resumes, all else equal. And this is without the ill intent of the data scientist. That's worth mentioning as well. It's not with a racist hiring manager. All right, that's a bad dude. But the data scientists, they just sort of overlooked the problem. They didn't realize that their data sets were imbalanced in various ways, blah, blah, blah. And so they didn't think to correct for them, or they do think to correct for them and they can't fix the problem because it turns out to be a technical hard problem to solve as well. So it does discriminate and it does it at scale.
Yeah, obviously discrimination is something we do not want in HR, really any facet of business. And we're going to talk more about the ethical framework of how we maybe move forward as an organization, but really around discrimination, how do you think about solving that, or what can organizations do when, say, a tech vendor comes to them and says, hey, I've got a new solution for you. It's going to look at all your resumes. It's going to do this. Yeah. How do you really make sure that you're not getting discrimination built into that AI?
There's a bunch to say here. One thing that's nice is that you raised nicely the point that this is an issue that applies to procurement. It's not just in-house design. So a lot of people, when they think about organizational AI ethical risk management program, they think about, well, we're not designing AI, we're not building AI, but look, everyone and their mother is building AI and trying to sell it to your organization. HR being a prime example of, there's tons of AI HR vendors trying to sell you stuff. What do you do with the vendor? So number one, you've got to have the processes in place such that the people in HR who are being sold to, they've got the right questions to ask those vendors. They have the right ways of identifying that there's ethical smoke here and they know, the as it were, the alarm to pull. And then it goes to the appropriate people. Think about it like cybersecurity. You don't get the HR person to look to see whether all the cyber stuff is on the up and up. You're going to give it to someone with some expertise in cybersecurity to vet the thing before it gets integrated into your system. So this is a similar kind of thing. There has to be something in the procurement process where things get flagged of needing additional review. When it comes to bias in particular, obviously you're going to have lots of questions for that vendor. Did you check for bias? How did you measure the bias? There's different ways of measuring bias. How did you measure the bias, or what metric did you use for measuring the bias? What metric did you choose? Why did you choose that metric? Why didn't you choose these other ones? What bias mitigation strategies did you engage in, or what are the tactics that you engaged in? Are there recommendations that you provide for how to best use this thing so as to minimize bias and how we use it, biased impacts as a result of how we use your tool? There's lots of questions to ask. There's really more technical stuff that the HR person is not going to engage in, but the data scientist will. Although there are, of course, data scientists within HR, as they're doing so, analytics and HR as the data scientists. And sometimes for some organizations that we work with, HR has the in-house expertise to have their people vet it. Other places, it's more centralized.
Yeah, that's great. I think those are great questions for HR leaders to be thinking about when they meet with HR tech vendors that are selling an AI that has a potential discrimination component. And even if you have an IO psychologist or data scientist who can look at that, you may not be able to get into the black box and see the actual calculation. So I think you've got to continue to be a really skeptical consumer and ask those tough questions and really make them produce something before you just sign up and trust them, right?
There's all sorts of software out there that does bias identification or bias measurement. One thing that's really important to highlight is that there's like 24 plus metrics for measuring bias. Let's talk about bias in the particular context that we're talking about, say green lighting or red lighting resumes for an interview, something like that. There's 24 plus metrics for bias because you're asking something like, okay, look, we've got this, call it a good, call an interview a good. So we're distributing these goods across giant populations with all these different subpopulations. And then you sit back and you ask, okay, wait a second, have we distributed this good in a fair, just way? One way to put it that people like to put it, I don't, but is this an equitable distribution? And then there's a whole literature called in machine learning fairness. This is all computer science stuff. And there are these measurements for these mathematical definitions of fairness, what they call anyway, mathematical definitions of fairness. And so you can say, okay, how well did we score on this metric? And how well did we score on that metric for fairness? And how about on that one? The thing is that these metrics they're mutually incompatible. So you literally can't score well on all of them at the same time. Scoring well on one of them necessarily entails scoring poorly on another. And so you've got this leftover question. From an ethical, reputational, legal, business perspective, what metric should we use here? Or at least what are the inappropriate ones that we should definitely take off the table? That's not, your tool won't tell you which is the appropriate one. Your tool will say, tell us which the right one is, and then we'll measure it. So you're right that leaders need to be aware that there are tools for this kind of thing, but there are big decisions that leaders need to make about how should we think about fairness and bias in this kind of context. If you're really prepared, then when a vendor comes to you and says, hey, we did bias mitigation, you say to them, well, what metric did you use for how did you measure that? And they say, I don't know. That's a problem. That's a red flag. If they say we used metric number one and your senior leader knows that's not what we think is the appropriate one for HR, don't work with them. Or say, can you run a test using metric number two and see how you score on that? There's lots of stuff to do, but those guardrails and what the goals are, that's for leadership. That's not for the average person in procurement or the average HR junior employee. It's not for them to decide.
Well, and I think what you're saying, and at least what I'm taking away, is that from an HR leader's perspective, when you assess whether I'm going to put in a new HR technology or implement a technology that we build internally, what's the risk? Like, what's the potential impact and the intended, unintended consequences of this technology, right? Hiring decisions, high bias, high risk situation where you want to make sure you get that right. There might be a lower risk situation for something else you're putting up with a chatbot, let's say, right? And it gets the wrong answer, even though I'm not sure that's a great example. But I think that's one thing, but discrimination is really, really important.
Think about predicting churn rate, internal matching between someone wants another job. Where can we promote them within the organization? Suppose you do something like this. Let's do this matching between existing employees and their roles and gaps in roles that we have now that we're looking to hire for. And when you say, if you like, let's hire someone who's been in this role in the past, who's been successful. Well, if most of the people have been, let's say, white males, then it's going to go looking for white men in order to match. How you create that matching software is going to matter in terms of whether or not it comes up with a biased output.
It's a great point. And there's the next one I was going to get into is actually talking about privacy and people's privacy. Because when you think about AI, one of the main concerns around AI is that, and I think you said this in your book, that AI, people's privacy is the fuel for AI, basically. It needs that data. So it's feeding off our data, right? And so when you go and think about a company, whether it's internal talent marketplace or other tools you're talking about, predicting turnover, it's using our data. And more, because if you're on a Microsoft suite, there's more and more data available in terms of like how you're using that time. I think people are very concerned about this privacy piece and the big brother. I know HR teams are struggling with this, but you've outlined kind of four ingredients of ethical privacy, if you will. Talk to us about what are the elements of ethical privacy and how should organizations be thinking about this, especially with their employees?
There's a couple of things to say here, probably more than a couple of things. I started actually getting very worried about privacy stuff for employees in particular at the start of the pandemic. So actually my very first Harvard Business Review article was on, can you, or here's how to ethically surveil employees, if that's possible. Surveil is already a bad word, but here's how to track data of employees in an ethical way, something like that. So I think it's a big concern. It's only becoming a big concern as remote work has taken off. And yeah, it's sort of waxing and waning, but there's all this nervous managers trying to get more data about their employees so they can see what's going on when they're not at the office. But then there's also just they're at the office and we've got tons of data. For the foreseeable future, employee privacy is going to be systematically violated unless the company has ethical guardrails around it. Because there are, as far as I know, virtually no protections for workers in the US anyway. European employees have more protections. US employees have basically none. Your life from 9 to 5, as it were, belongs to the company. They're using all these tools and more tools, collecting more and more data about them. I think companies are probably in a sticky spot. On the one hand, they want to increase productivity, they want to increase efficiency, et cetera, et cetera. But they're going to alienate employees by taking data about them and using it for all sorts of reasons. It's interesting, though. This is a place where I think HR is really behind. I work with lots of mostly Fortune 500 organizations building AI ethical guardrails and programs or responsible AI programs, whatever you call it, that are enterprise-wide. And one thing that we always start with when we're talking about what are your guardrails, we have an entire section on employee data. So how are you going to treat your employees with regards to the data that they generate, et cetera, et cetera. And I'd be lying if I said most of them were like, yeah, let's keep this section and have and protect our employees. Most of them are like, that's a separate thing. That's not for the responsible AI program. That's a different thing. This is really about the products that we use and the products that we procure and how it impacts internal efficiencies and how it impacts our customers, our consumers. HR doesn't have a loud enough voice, as far as I can see. We always tell all of our clients, bring in someone senior from HR to work on this as well. And some do and some don't. And don't get me wrong, some companies that we work with absolutely include ethical guardrails around how employee data is handled. But a lot don't. It's one place where HR probably needs to speak up a lot more, insofar as HR is interested in protecting the privacy of employees. Insofar as HR is interested in protecting the interests of the employer, they're not going to fight for the data privacy of employees. And then there's these questions about, well, what constitutes sufficient respect of privacy, et cetera, et cetera.
There's some gray area in there, but I think my experience, most HR leaders are trying to find the happy medium. Like they want to protect people's privacy. They also want data to understand like, well, how can we make sure we're great employee experience and managing turnover and helping build people's careers? I know a lot of people in analytics folks are also, there's definitely things that are like off limits for them to put into data sets and thinking about, right?
Yeah.
There's all kinds of data we can pull, but the point you're bringing up is the right question. Like from an HR perspective, what's ethical? What can we sort of sleep at night knowing we're collecting our employees? Yeah. And if we, I guess for myself, I always think if we're pulling some data about an employee, would I be okay saying, hey, just telling them that? We should be confident saying, hey, this is what we're doing right now. We're collecting information on how you use Teams. Do you feel good about that or not? Yeah. If I don't feel good about telling that to somebody, I probably shouldn't be measuring it. It's how I think about it.
Yeah,
you think about it differently?
Yes. Two things broadly. First of all, some people, let's take an extreme case. Some people are shameless. They feel fine telling them because they have no shame. That's one thing to say. And that's the extreme. And then there's the good people. Let's say you were like, yeah, I have a good conscience, a strong conscience, et cetera, et cetera. And there's everybody in between. There's going to be so much variance about, do I feel comfortable telling them that I'm collecting this data? Some are going to be like hardcore. Look, you're an employee. You know you're using company hardware and software. So I feel comfortable telling you that anything that you generate, any data that you create using our hardware and software while at work that we pay you for, that's our data. That's not a crazy line of thought. It might not be the right line of thought, but it's not a crazy line of thought. There's going to be lots of people like that. then there are other going to be other people that think, no. I might be an employee, but I'm first and foremost an individual. I'm a person who deserves respect for my privacy, et cetera. So yes, I'm using your stuff, but that doesn't give you the right to peer into this and that. That's also not a crazy position. So there's lots of non-crazy positions that lead to completely opposite actions. So that can't be the standard. What does one feel comfortable doing? That's one thing to say. The other thing to say is that there's two places to sort of intervene. One place is in the collection of the data, and another is in how you use the data. So you might think, there's a way in which sometimes I think people are too worked up over data privacy, and what they should be really worked up about is the way in which it's used. You're a Fortune 500 company and you collect just a tremendous amount of employee data that gets thrown into these giant servers and they're aggregated. Maybe it's anonymized, maybe it's not. No individual person is looking at it, and nothing is ever done with that data. Has employee privacy been violated? I don't know. It's not, maybe, probably, if so, it's like a paper cut, like the analog of a paper cut in terms of moral wrongs. Now, what if they use it, though, to make decisions about who they're going to fire? Okay, now we're talking about something different. But now my concern is less about privacy, and it's more about you're using it in this really high-stakes thing. Maybe people didn't know about it. There's at least greater ethical dimensions to that that need to be considered. One place you can push around this issue is the collection of the data itself. And another place you can play around with, as it were, is what we will and will not do with it. So you could say, listen, we're going to collect your data. We're a company. One thing that we're trying to do, by the way, is we're trying to look out for, say, people who we suspect are suffering from various mental health issues and can use some extra help so that we don't lose them. They don't quit because they're too overwhelmed, blah, blah, blah. They need some extra help. You want to provide that extra help. So we have good intentions, good outcomes. That's what we aim for. And so we will collect the data, but we will never use it for promotions. We'll never use it for firing people. We'll never use it for whatever, X, Y, and Z.
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting point. I mean, I see the philosophy degree coming through, Reed. So I will not out-philosophize you on this, but even that last situation you brought up, there's just a lot of gray areas when you think about this ethical AI and so many different situations that organizations really need to think through. That's sort of what it's hitting me is, as an HR leader, being pulled in early to start thinking through the use cases and what will come up and what we'll say yes to, what we won't say yes to. Yeah. Because I agree with you, it's one thing to collect the data and never actually use it. But once you start to make decisions on that, or the mental health piece, that's a very personal decision. I mean, it might be some HIPAA stuff, but the reality is some people may not be comfortable knowing you know that information about me. So I think it's really interesting, just dynamics you're bringing up around this.
One last thing. There's two kinds of things that need to be paid attention to when we're talking about these use cases. One is, to what extent can the organization define certain use cases as just beyond the pale? These are just things we're not going to do. The second is, can we build systems by which, or processes by which, we can flag those gray area cases where it's not clear either A, whether the policy applies, or whether B, we should have a new policy that does apply, in this case, and forbids it, or something along those lines. So when they can smell ethical smoke, it's not clearly against policy. The data science, they're like, no, it's not against the policy, but there's something, we've done a risk assessment, and this risk assessment is a gray area. Do they have the appropriate body to escalate the issue to? And is that body comprised of the appropriate people, cross-functional, cross-department roles with the appropriate kind of training to handle these? You said gray area cases. I might say complex areas. That's the two things to keep track of. What are the use cases that we're just not going to do? And what are the use cases, the ones that should be escalated to the appropriate body?
That's a great mental framework. Let's talk a little more about the ethical framework for AI that you have talked about to organizations. And what does that look like to start to put this in place at a high level? How do you think about doing this and putting that kind of that framework there so people can be more ethical in how they use AI?
People use the word framework in all these weird ways. As a former academic, it drives me absolutely nuts that a framework can mean anything from pie chart infographic with some buzzwords on it all the way through to detailed policy and procedures and metrics and racy matrices. And like the word framework, it covers such a wide range of things. One thing I would say is that the frameworks always need to be customized to the organization. So there are some industry agnostic generic frameworks that are really good in some respects. So like NIST. NIST has a great risk management framework for AI. It's one of the few things that I've read that I've thought, okay, the people who wrote this, they know what they're talking about. Usually I read these sort of frameworks that a consulting company puts out and I roll my eyes. But this was something that I thought, okay, this is super smart. It's written, clearly written by smart people. The problem is that it's necessarily generic. It doesn't speak to any particular size or any particular industry. But different organizations are built differently, completely. And so if you're going to start with a generic framework, there still has to be a lot of customization involved. Or you just start off with building a customized framework. And here I'm thinking about, All right, what do governance structures and governance entities look like? To whom does it get escalated? Under what conditions does it get escalated? What are the policies around this? How do we track compliance with the policy? How do we track the impact of compliance with that policy? That's all part of the framework. What are the major risk categories? There's some obvious ones like there's privacy and there's bias and there's transparency and accountability. Those are pretty much in everybody's quote-unquote framework. There's different ways of divvying it up, but I guess I'm rambling a bit at this point. But I think the main thing that I want to say in response to the framework question is your organization might have a strong sort of legal department that has its fingers in lots of stuff, and you're going to want to build your AI ethics program or your responsible AI program around those existing governance structures and government processes and metrics and et cetera, et cetera. Or it might not. Maybe the privacy people are really strong. Maybe the cyber people are really strong. Maybe the IT is the right place to put it. So I've worked with all the different organizations where it doesn't always live in the same place. The framework is not always the same here as it is over there. It might depend on what your org chart looks like. Am I answering your question or is this just unhelpful rambling?
No, you're answering the question. That's actually where I was going to. My mind was thinking, is there a place or who should own the ethical AI policy? And you answered, which it sounds like it's not one size fits all. It's not generic. This needs to really fit your organization and really think about business, the industry, and where you've had success putting types of policies in place and having teeth and accountability and buy-in.
Yeah. One of my clients, it's essentially owned by the CISO, the Chief Information Security Officer, which is unusual, but it just works there. That's where it makes sense. Given the organization, how it's structured and et cetera, that's who it makes sense that it should, that's who owns it. Another place, lots of other places, actually, it's like a chief data officer or a chief analytics officer or chief data analytics officer. Another organization is their chief technology officer. There's not like the role. It's almost, I should say this, at the moment, it's almost always someone in the C-suite on the tech side of the house. Almost, mm-hmm. I think that's true in all cases. There's one organization where legal is very involved. A senior level executive in legal is highly involved, but it's owned by the CISO. Maybe that's going to change. Maybe that's going to change to governance, risk, and compliance with the advent of the EU AI Act. At least in Europe, it might change. But in the US so far, it's someone on the C-suite on the tech side of the house. And then one question that's very asked often is, do we need a chief AI ethics officer or chief AI risk officer? And the answer to that is probably, but not yet. Any responsible AI or AI ethics program is rolled out in phases, at least if you're talking about some giant organization. It's rolled out in phases. And so you might have, and those phases are marked by different kinds of milestones. And one of those phases, it might be appropriate to say, assess whether at this point it's appropriate to create a new function, the chief AI ethics officer or something along those lines, but not out of the gate, not out of the gate.
That's great. It's helpful to understand that. For HR leaders who are listening, what would you recommend in terms of them taking a proactive step to address AI ethics in their organization? What would you advise they go do as a first step?
I think HR is very important. In fact, when we do learning and development, when we do training programs, one of the first units that we target is HR because they're dealing with all these people data. And as we talked about earlier, there's so many vendors in the AI HR space that are selling to these people and they might not know the risks. I think that HR is not going to own this. I've never seen HR owning it. For most HR leaders, honestly, one of the things is don't be intellectually intimidated. I think this is a big, big problem for not just HR, but for any of the non-techies. They think, oh my, AI, like I don't know what AI, artificial machine learning, neural networks, generative AI, that's math and coding and computer science. And I don't know anything. I'm an HR person. I'm a marketing person. That's not for me. The first thing is you got to get that out of your head. It's totally for you. And look, I don't understand AI at the coding or math level. I'm a philosopher by training. I'm not a coder. I'm not particularly good at math. But at the conceptual level, I understand AI, I think, pretty well. And so can most anybody else. That's why I said software that learns by example. AI is software that learns by example. And if you get the concepts down, if you have the right person teaching you, you're going to learn at the conceptual level. And then I think the job of HR leaders is to get involved in the conversation in terms of what the program is going to look like. In many cases, they're going to be making sure that people are complying with the AI policy. So they're certainly going to be deeply involved in the implementation of the program. And they're going to have to be involved in overseeing how does the training, how does the learning and development around this sort of thing go, and how do we integrate it into current L&D efforts? I think it's really just making sure that they're part of the conversation in the design and implementation of the program, but they don't have to own it, but they have to be part of it.
I think that's great. Not be intimidated by that and just really kind of get in there and start to understand it better. I also think the role that HR can play in making sure that we're communicating to the organization that we are taking an ethical stance on AI is really important from the trust and transparency piece, because a lot of the employees aren't really sure how it's being thought about and rolled out. So that's great.
That's how I think about AI Ethics 101 training module for employees. One can think about it is that there should be something like three layers of education here that HR needs to get behind and also receive themselves. The first is organizational specific, but role agnostic training. I don't care who you are in the organization. If you're a data scientist or an HR or marketing, here are the ethical and reputational and regulatory risks associated with AI. And here's how we as an organization deal with that stuff. We have a policy. Here's where it's housed. These are the kinds of things that we're committing to, blah, blah. This is mostly about awareness training. And then level two is, call it 201, 201A, 201B, 201C, where 201A is for data scientists. 201B is for HR. 201C is for marketing. That's where you get both organizational specific and role specific or department specific training. So you're in HR. Here's how you need to think about, for instance, your workflows as they relate to integrating the AI ethics principles into your workflows. So there's that level of training. And then finally, at that third level of training, it's organizational specific, role specific, and tool specific. So for this particular tool that you're using, maybe it's a matching algorithm, matching AI to existing employees to open roles. Maybe it's reading resumes. Maybe it's predicting churn, whatever it is. Here's training for this particular tool, given our AI ethics commitments, principles, et cetera.
Really helpful. Very helpful. Thanks, Reid, for going through that. Reid, last question for you. It's a question I ask all my guests, which is, what's one word or phrase that you believe will define the future of HR over the next 5 to 10 years?
What's one phrase that will define the future of HR in the next 10 years? Let's see here. I suppose I just want to say, look, one reason why AI is really powerful is that it's really good at predicting stuff. That's what it is. It predicts. It's a predicting machines. And the one reason why AI is so useful is that people are really bad at predictions. If we were really good, we wouldn't need AI. But the problem is that there's so many variables and we have so many cognitive deficiencies, or at least so many opportunities for improvement, that we can't predict well. So when you ask me, what should we predict? You should predict that there's no way of knowing what the hell is going to happen to HR in 10 years.
I'm so like a true philosopher.
Yeah, right.
I love it. Love it. Reid, hey, thank you so much for coming on and talking about ethical AI. The book is Ethical Machines. Really enjoyed the conversation. It was great.
Yeah. Likewise. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Future of HR Podcast. Thanks again to Reid for sharing his insights from his book, Ethical Machines. I think we all learned a lot. As always, you can go to futureofhr.com to view all of our past episodes and learn more about our mission to inspire the next generation of HR leaders. And if you enjoyed this episode of Future of HR, be sure to subscribe or share our podcast with at least one other person, or even better, leave a review on Apple or Spotify podcasts. This really helps us to grow the podcast and helps with our mission of inspiring the next generation of HR leaders. We'll be back next week with Scott Anthony. Scott is a professor at the Tuck School of Business at Dartmouth College, where he teaches a course called Leading Disruptive Change, and he's a managing director and managing partner emeritus at Innosight, where he helps leaders design growth strategies, build innovation capabilities, navigate disruptive innovation, and manage strategic transformation. In my conversation with Scott, we're going to go deep into his latest book, Eat, Sleep, Innovate. Trust me, if you are building an innovative culture, this is one conversation you will not want to miss. Thanks again for listening to Future of HR and being part of our community.